Hello, nerds. Welcome to Captain's Quarters, the unofficial Star Trek rewatch podcast, where we are rewatching the entire Star Trek franchise, starting at the beginning of the official chronology, starting with Star Trek Enterprise. Today, we're talking about Star Trek Enterprise Season 3, Episode 23, which is called Countdown. My name's Gabe, and I'm with my co-captain, Jason. Make it so, Jason.
Hello there, how are you?
I'm fantastic.
The penultimate episode of the season.
That's true. And Jason, I watched this twice.
Oh,
over the week. Because we were supposed to do this... No, I'm sorry. We were supposed to do it... Like, normally my schedule is I watch it on Tuesday and we do this on Wednesday. And we didn't do... last night, so I watched it again today, and I have to say this episode.
Was there a reason?
Did you enjoy it
that much?
It was half my fault, half the episode's fault. I kept falling asleep the first time.
Oh, that's boding well for this episode so far.
Yeah, but then also I was just like, I was reading like a synopsis of it, and it was just. I couldn't distinguish it from the previous episode, The Council. I feel like this episode...
Close.
Yeah, I feel like these... It was basically just one long episode, if you combine The Council and this one.
Yeah.
And so, in the last episode, the reptilian Zindi had stolen the Doomsday weapon and gone into... subspace of some sort.
Yeah, the vortex
with the weapon. The Enterprise is pursuing them. The reptilians needed three codes from the Council to actually activate the weapon. So they had two. They had the reptilians and the insectoids. And we find out in this episode where they were getting the third. And that is they kidnapped Ensign Sato, Hoshi Sato, last episode, and in this episode we find out why is they're using her cryptology skills to crack the code and basically decrypt the password, right?
Yeah, I mean that's absolutely correct. The reptilians believe that her language ability skills translates into breaking codes.
Right.
I don't know where they get that, but whatever.
Yeah, I said cryptology. I don't know the difference between cryptography.
No, that's what he did. That's what he said. That's what Dolem said.
Yeah, and there's another one. There's three words that are very similar that I don't know the difference, but... Archer... is able to convince the remaining Zindi to pursue the reptilians because he convinces them that it's not just to like, hey, do us humans a favor, do this for your own survival, because these sphere builders who convinced them in the first place to kill the humans with this doomsday weapon, they're lying because they are building these spheres to take over our pocket of space. And in the future, the Zindi and the humans are going to unite and create like a coalition that destroys the sphere builders. So this is whole one big grand Palpatinian scheme by the sphere builders to stop this future war. And so Archer convinces them of that, finally. And so they all pursue the reptilians and attack them. And there's a pretty cool space battle. But during the space battle, these sphere builders use spatial anomalies to basically win the space battle. They make these spatial anomalies like appear, and it destroys a bunch of ships. The reptilians are able to get away again. And it's at this point when the insectoids realize that they've been deceived, because they say those spatial anomalies were in our favor. And Archer was saying that that the Guardians, as we know them, are also the ones who built the spears. So obviously, he was right. And now we don't believe the Reptilians that Daigra was a traitor and all this stuff. And so the Reptilians, realizing the Insectoids are about to turn on them, blast the Insectoids out of the sky. And they continue on their path towards Earth with the weapon. And I think it ends in a cliffhanger there. And the other subplot is that Reed is dealing with the fact that he took one of Major Hayes's Makos into one of the spheres to get its sort of core, which was like this computer that had a bunch of information about the spheres and the Guardians. And then that Mako died. So Reed is dealing with the guilt of losing Hayes's man, but also like him and Hayes have never been cool. So now there's like some tension there. And then Hayes actually ends up getting killed in a rescue mission to rescue Sato. That was a pretty good scene. We could talk about that. And T'Pol continues to deal with her inability to control her emotions from her Trillium D experimentation phase.
We can call it an addiction. Let's just call it an addiction. Okay. She was addicted.
It's true. Yeah, she's beyond experimenting. So anyway, that was the broad strokes. What'd you think, my man?
You saw it twice. I'm interested in wanting to hear what you thought first.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just so ready for this stupid season to be over. Like, I'm probably gonna watch the finale tonight after this episode.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Normally I would wait until Tuesday, but just the that carrot dangling in front of me of being done with this. I've enjoyed spending time with you and talking about it. I mean, that's why we're doing this.
Yep, absolutely.
And that part has been great, but it has been such a slow crawl. And like I said, I can't really figure out what progress was made in this episode that wasn't already established in the last one, other than Archer actually does convince the other Zindi to turn on the Reptilians and the Guardians, yep. Which is a huge deal. That's a big deal.
Yeah.
And it's obviously a big deal that Hayes dies and...
So Hayes dies. Oh no.
Yeah. Spoiler alert for the 20-year-old show.
Spoiler alert. Yep, exactly.
But I think it just underscores how long we've been talking about the humans trying to stop this weapon and how many twists and turns it has been to get here, and most of those twists and turns have not been worth it. Some of them have been great. We've talked about recently some great episodes.
I'm with you.
But
I'm with you.
I feel like the other ones sort of weigh it down, and I'm ready to move on.
Okay.
So. Yeah.
Okay. So let me just bring it our conversation quickly back to a little bit ago. Mm-hmm. So cryptography is the art of writing or solving puzzles and codes.
Mm-hmm.
And a cryptologist is just a person who enjoys that venture, solving codes and puzzles. So that's mm-hmm. what you were talking about before when we were talking about Hoshi Sato.
Sato, yeah.
Yeah. And... so when Commander Dolom, I wanted to mention when Commander Dolom injects the neuroparasites into Hoshi's brain, that was incredibly reminiscent of what Khan does to Chekhov and Captain Terrell in Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan, where he puts the little youngling worm things into Chekhov and Terrell's helmet, and they crawl into it, and they crawl into their ears. It's kind of a gruesome scene, but in Star Trek II, especially when you're only, you know.
And why did why does he do that?
To Sato, to make them more compliant to his orders and suggestions, so that she that they will do what he asks.
And sorry, so is it a good guy? Is it a good guy doing it to a bad guy?
No. Very much like Commander Dolan.
Okay.
Trying to get them to do some pretty nasty things.
Got it. You know what's interesting?
In this case.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so they're doing that to Sato, and she spits in Dolan's face.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah. I just is like, I was like, wow, that was so unlike Sato.
Yeah.
I mean, like, it was like her to be resilient, but it was unlike her to spit in someone's face. Like, and it, I feel like it was very un Star Trek as well. It was very, like,
yes,
unbecoming of a Starfleet ensign. I don't know. I was surprised.
This is very, very early. This is very, very early in. You know, Starfleet, you know, you know, Starfleet etiquette, I guess. Yeah. But yeah, totally.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry. What were we saying? Do you remember?
No. I was just drawing the reminiscent parallels of what Dolan and Khan did to our favorite, some of our favorite characters. So.
Cool.
But I'm with you. So you touched on it, and let's get into it because I think it's one of the highlights of this episode. And that in the Reed Hayes relationship, I thought that was kind of nice to have it come full circle.
Yeah.
Really,
yeah.
Where they have an understanding of one another, and where Reed finally, ultimately, you know, admits that they are part of the crew, and that Hayes is also feeling like they're also part of the crew. And, you know, as Speaker Halfley says, we dole it out like children, candy to children, a billion here and a billion there. Sorry. So let me give context to that. So Major Hayes is played by Stephen Culp, and Stephen Culp was Speaker Halfley in The West Wing.
Ah.
In a couple of episodes. So I was just quoting his character from The West Wing. But anyways, yeah, it was. I think that was one of the highlights of the episode, where there was some closure, and then, you know, when he gets shot.
Yeah, yeah.
In the chest when he gets transported out, that took me back to something that we were talking about earlier a little bit. The Harry Potter series. It's like when Dobby gets stabbed.
Oh yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I was like, oh no.
Yeah. Yeah, it was interesting.
Oh no, Dobby.
Because you learn like how the transporter works. It's like. Because when he was shot, he was like just a split second away from being fully transported. Like,
yeah.
At the point he was shot, his atoms were already like apart,
yeah,
and being transported. But like just the residual atoms that were there got hit,
yeah,
so that when he came together on the other side, it was enough that it was a fatal hit and Phlox couldn't save him.
Yep, and to your point, and that I want to make a point out of, because that was so deliberately well done, that just because you are being transported doesn't mean, you know, that keeps you from prevents you from dying, you know, or falling off a cliff, or, you know, whatever the case might be. It was at that moment, right? And that was beautifully done. I mean, it was sad, but again, beautifully done, as you so eloquently detailed just then, that as he was the initial transport, he gets shot, and, you know, you can still get hurt. So I thought that was really well done.
Yeah. Good call on the Dobby thing. You're right. That was exactly the same.
I was like, oh no! Harry Potter cannot go back to school.
This reminds me of in Breaking Bad. I know you haven't seen, right?
But
you know it's about a teacher who starts selling meth. So
yes, I know that much.
Yeah, so his partner is this like tweaker guy played by Aaron Paul, and he has these two friends, Badger and I think Pete is the other one, and they're like in Aaron's house that he bought with meth, and they're all drugged up, and they're like having this conversation about Star Trek, and Badger.
Okay.
Badger is, or no, I think it's Pete. I think in Pete's head, he's saying that in Star Trek, that every time you're transported, because it's like ripping your atoms apart.
Yeah, yeah.
That's mm-hmm, the yep. same as death.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because like, if you were to like tear someone's atoms apart, you'd be dead, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
But you're reassembling them.
Mm-hmm.
And so Pete's argument is that every time you do that, you're dying. But every time they're reassembled, you're born again. And so that like these Star Trek characters, every time they do that, technically are dying and being reborn over and over again. And it's just this comic relief in the show because they're just like, you know, tweaked out of their mind and just rambling on about nothing. But
no, that's actually... you know, that's actually a conversation that you hear, you know, there's so many science, you know, episodes of, you know, the science of Star Trek and all that kind of stuff and on television. And that's one of the things that's been talked about quite a few times is that, when you're being transported, you're technically, as you said, your atoms are getting ripped apart and, you know, spread out into space and then, you know, brought back together again. And that's absolutely, that's something that I've heard many times over and over again.
Okay.
For sure.
So that was not a Breaking Bad original.
No, I don't. Okay. I mean, it may have.
No, I don't think so.
But that conversation's been had quite a few times I've seen on television.
Okay. Anyway, I thought that was just apt right now. So
yeah.
And then so with T'Pol and Trip, I think this episode was just important for their relationship because she was letting him in on like what she's been dealing with. Even if she didn't explicitly talk about the Trillium D, she at least was saying that she's like struggling with this and he is there to help her. So
I mean, when she says Trip.
Yeah. Very un-T'Pol like.
I'm like, whoa, that was...
Yeah.
I don't know about you, but did that like hit home for you? I'm like, whoa, that was
The second time
like
I watched it.
That was like a call for help for me.
Yeah.
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 I was like, whoa, wow, that's like, help!
Yeah. Yeah, that's like so unlike T'Pol.
It's, yes.
So that's how you know it was very authentic.
Yes.
Yeah. But I am curious to see where that goes. You know, as we know, in an alternate timeline, they end up together and have children. So I wonder if they're fated to end up together in any eventuality.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think so? Do you think season 4 will have a wedding between T'Pol and Trip?
I don't I don't see a wedding per se, but I do see a... a joining of the of a union in a sense. I think that it seems like it's gonna go, and yes, there is gonna be a romantic relationship, but I just see too many like bumps in the road to not to say that I don't think they'll end up together. I don't know, but I do believe we'll see, you know, obviously, a continuation and a deepening of the relationship for sure. I'm not sure if we'll see, you know, the wedding episode in season 4. You know.
Got it.
In the cargo bay or wherever.
Yeah.
So, I wanted to ask you, what did you think? So we talk about Archer. We talk about characters when we have a chance. And there were two things about Archer in this episode that kind of stood out to me. Where his desperation in trying to stop the weapon and try to convince the aquatics to join them. What did you think of that bluff?
What was the bluff?
So he basically had said that we found a way to destroy one of the probes or one of the spheres. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
They were getting there and they were working on it.
Right.
But he kind of misleads.
Interesting.
The aquatics to join them.
Well, okay, so just to back up, because I don't think I set the stage.
Oh, okay.
So one of the first things that happens in this episode, so they stole that core, that computer from that one sphere in last episode. They've analyzed it, T'Pol has, and she's saying that the spheres are all linked by this network, and there's four spheres that are like, special, they're like control units, and so they think that if they can damage one of those four, they can take down this network and like cripple the Guardians, and they name that sphere something 41, sphere 41,
yeah, sphere 41, yeah.
So I got to be honest, man. So later when Archer told that to the aquatics, I assumed that maybe there was an additional conversation. Because we know that T'Pol was working on it, her and Trip were.
Yeah, Tucker and T'Pol were working on that. Yeah.
Yeah, that conversation we were just talking about, that was them working on it. And they were just talking about emotions while they were working on this problem. So I guess I just assumed that perhaps she had found a way and things had progressed in such a way that Archer could make that statement.
No, because by that time, that's how it broke into the disagreement between Tucker and T'Pol, is because T'Pol kept saying, oh, we need to try this with the deflector dish and try that. And Tucker kept shooting her down and saying, no, that's not going to work because it's going to destroy the ship. And so there's that tension that builds in that scene, and then it kind of boils over, and it, you know, Tucker starts to walk out, and he's like, I'm going to do this in engineering.
Yeah.
And then she finally, you know, and she finally goes, Trip, right?
Right.
So he was, I think that's part of, and that's why there was tension there, was because they were kind of under the gun. Because the captain had made a promise that, you know, a false one, but they were working on it. But he wasn't incredibly, you know, he wasn't as forthcoming.
Got it. So, you
know, he stated,
so that...
oh, we know how to destroy it, but No.
So the scene with Tucker and T'Pol working on the problem, that occurs after Archer makes the promise?
Yeah.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I missed that, and I think it was just because I had seen it twice, I knew where the scenes were, but I was like just not. But yeah, that's interesting. Good for him. You know,
because, you know, God forbid, you know, that they don't find a way to destroy
him. I mean, I think
the captain's, you know, caught between, you know, caught with his tail between his legs.
Yeah. Well, I think you could read it either way. Either he just has the utmost faith in his crew and the ability to figure it out.
Totally.
Or he had nothing to
desperate
lose.
Desperate man.
Yeah.
And then the other one that I wanted to point out that I was like, oh, okay, the name of the game is Risk, but the risk that he was taking by transporting an unconscious Hoshi Sato onto Dagger's ship while she's still unconscious.
Yeah.
I was like, wow.
Yep.
Gambling with your lieutenant's life there just because you need information about the interior of the ship.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, the weapon they were going after, the weapon,
right? Yep. Yeah, that was a very Archer moment, which is acting like a Vulcan. The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. What's
the
saying?
The needs of the few. Yep, exactly. Or the one.
Yeah.
Or the one.
Archer has repeatedly demonstrated that he's willing to sacrifice for the needs of the many. So, or to risk sacrificing.
Yeah.
And then the only other thing I wanted to talk about was just with the Guardians. They keep, in this episode, it was kind of cool because when we would watch them as the audience, we would experience them in this weird, like, dimension, this this weird temporal shifting dimension. They were just kind of like floating in the ether.
Mm-hmm.
But talking to each other, so in a way they were sort of, it was almost like breaking the fourth wall, kind of, because it was they were just kind of like giving this perspective on the events that were happening for us. And so anytime something happened in the episode, they would like chime in, or it happened like once or twice, whatever, or two or three times, and they were like, oh, the.
But it's happened in every episode, almost every episode that we've seen them interacting together. They've been in this void.
Yeah. But just the idea of that, the, you know, the future is always in motion.
Their COVID bubble.
Yeah. Just to borrow from Star Wars, you know, always in motion. The future is, you know, like just. Just the butterfly effect in real time of humans are doing this now. Some of the outcomes that we're able to see indicate that the humans are going to win. And at one point Dalum is saying, well, can't you go back in time and get the code from the aquatics? And they're like, it doesn't work like that. We can't see minute details. We can only see like the broad strokes. So we just learned a lot about how they're experiencing the future and the past and what they can and cannot do. And it's almost like they're working on probabilities. They're like, well, we can see like X number of futures, and this subset of them ends in this way, this subset ends this way. And it's just kind of like they're just doing math at that point. I just thought that was kind of cool. So, well, hey,
no,
Jason.
It's very cool. No, it's very cool.
Yeah. How do you think the next episode is going to go? How do you think the season's going to end? And how do you want it to end?
Wow. Okay. So one other thing. I just wanted to say we get to learn that the Aquatics built the weapon under Degra's kind of supervision order, I guess. But so that was really interesting. How do I think it's going to go? I'm hopeful that they obviously stop the weapon, but I would like to see it that they are again outgunned, outmatched, and the crew on Degra's ship, meaning the captain, Hoshi Sato, and I don't know who else was on there. Maybe it was Reed. It was Reed. I think they stopped the weapon, but I think it's going to take help, and because Dolom kills and destroys two insectoid ships, I'm hoping the other Zindi that followed Dolom actually, you know, make a surprise twist to save them. But I also think that the cliffhanger is that in the process of destroying the weapon, we don't know what happens to Archer and Sato and Reed on Degra's ship. I think we're going to be led to believe that they are killed, you know, in that fight,
okay,
while trying to save the weapon. And I hope that the end is on board the Enterprise. You're either seeing the weapon and Degra's ship be destroyed, and then end up, you see, you know, after a little bit of shock and stuff, that T'Pol and Tucker invite the rest of the Zindi on board and declare themselves allies. And that's what I hope to see.
Okay.
But I think we'll see the destruction, and the cliffhanger, I think, will be the away team. And I think that we're going to see them. You're going to be like, oh, what happened to them? It's Sato, Reed, and Captain Archer.
Got it.
And then I think, see, as we get into season 4, I think it'll be the search for those three. And whether it was Daniels that gets him out, or, you know, whatever, whoever pulls him out of danger in that last second, or whatever the case might be, I think that's what will happen as a cliffhanger.
Interesting.
What about you?
Well, they introduced this Sphere 41 thing. So yes. I think they're going to use the weapon to destroy the sphere. So I don't know if maybe somehow they trick the reptilians into it. Maybe they convince the reptilians to do the right thing. Somehow maybe they activate the weapon remotely. But I do think for sure they're going to destroy the sphere with the weapon, and that's going to destroy all the spheres. It's going to be like a Death Star chain reaction thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll end the conflict with the sphere builders. And honestly, that's as far as I thought. I do like what you were saying, though. Like, because like maybe they go into that dimension to do this, but then the dimension gets closed off, because without the spheres,
right,
they're closed off.
That's an excellent point that I totally forgot.
Yeah. And what I hope is that that they're able to like they're able to destroy the spheres without getting lost in the dimension, and then it's a really happy ending and they're all celebrating, and they open they get to have movie night again for the first time because they're rebuilding the Enterprise still.
Oh, that's a good one.
But it's a very happy ending, and then Trip says to Archer, he goes, so should we get out of this expanse? And Archer goes, there's one stop we need to make. And the final shot is him going and returning the warp coils to those people he stole it from. And they're like all like grumpy and pissed off. They've been like trolling along for like 2 months and they're just like all disheveled and like, you know, like kind of shipwrecked.
Okay.
And he gives them the warp coils and goes, sorry about that. And he like gives them something to like make amends. And then that's the end of it.
Okay. Okay. I like that. I like that. I like that. I like that. I like that a lot, actually. I like that a lot. I like that. Yeah.
Still haven't let go of that one.
I know. It's a tough one. I know. It's a tough one. I know. That was a bitter pill. Yeah, I know. I was like, come on, man. You got to write that wrong. But I like that. Yes. Yes. I like that very much.
Well, was there anything else about this episode you want to talk about? I think we covered it pretty good.
Yeah, I just... Again, one of my complaints... You know, this is a complaint that I've had for probably the entire season. Of this arc, anyways. It's how quickly, you know, the aquatics kind of... The arboreal and the primate and the aquatic Zindi kind of join forces and join Archer's join this quest and join this mission. I just wish again that there was a little bit more character development.
This,
and I was like, oh, okay, that just happens in, you know, a handful of episodes, and you know,
right. Yeah.
Rally the troops and, you know, warp into action pretty quickly. And there was no kind of build up there. I mean, a little bit, but it all happened in, you know, a handful of episodes. So, you know, again, it's my, you know, my general, like, there wasn't really a story. This was very much a plot-driven episode, and again, you know, little character development. That's why I get so excited. That's why I get excited when, you know, we get to see Reed and Hayes, and then T'Pol and Tucker and that, those relationships.
Well, so on that note, though, so like with Dalum, the reptilian Zindi. So I wonder though if the absence of like character development and really building his motives and who he is. I wonder if that's indicating maybe his, or that's foreshadowing his true intentions. Like maybe he's like acting as if this weapon is to save the Zindi species, but really It was a Palpatine move of like, we need to arm ourselves. We need to build this thing to stop this immediate threat, when really he's trying to achieve having the weapon.
Yeah.
And so so maybe he's like, he thinks he's going to destroy Earth, but now he has this weapon and now he can take over the universe.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it could be as simple as his reptilian brain. And I mean that in a very literal sense, that he's a, you know, a reptilian Zindi, but the reptile brain, you know, in him, in our idioms, that's actually what's really at the basis of it was the preservation of one, his species, and then the dominance of, you know, his species over everybody else. Totally.
Because his ability to ignore evidence to the contrary is suspicious. So to me, it's indicating that he's willfully just ignoring the evidence because he kind of doesn't care that the other races are going to get destroyed, because he thinks, I'm going to get them to build this weapon for me.
Yeah.
And now I'm going to have this Death Star, and now I'll have the ultimate power to rule
the galaxy. I mean, murdering Degra in cold blood and then destroying those two insectoid ships.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Absolutely.
He's Grand Moff Tarkin.
Absolutely.
So. Anyway. I was just saying that with regard to... you know what? It wasn't Tarkin. It was the other officer who says... It's Tarkin who says, fear of this battle station.
Yeah, it's Tarkin.
Fear will keep the... The systems in line. And then Vader says, don't be too sure of this thing you've built, right?
Yep, absolutely.
Okay. All right.
And we'll destroy the rebellion in one swift stroke.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of Star Wars, so Andor's going great. It's still maybe my favorite show of all time.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, let me pull it back to this episode real quick. Okay. I just want to say, director, Lieutenant Tom Paris, awesome. Robert Duncan McNeil, excuse me. End date, I believe we got an end date of February 13th, 2154.
Yep.
And then the inside of the subspace vortex, just for those Star Trek fans, I believe, I'm pretty sure, that the interior of the subspace vortex was a recycled Borg transwarp hub from Voyager and... Yeah, from a couple of episodes from Star Trek Voyager. I was like, oh, they just reused the Borg transport hub for the subspace vortex. So I just wanted to mention those. Okay, now let's get back to Andor.
Hold on. Yeah. In-universe, was it supposed to be from the Borg? Or are you just saying from production?
No, I'm saying, so in-universe, I believe it was February 13th, 2154.
Yeah.
And then in-universe... So basically the production team basically recycled, when we get into the subspace vortex, they used it was very similar to the Borg transport hub from Voyager. So Star Trek has a history of recycling scenes.
Okay.
backgrounds. Bridge redresses, set redresses, and stuff like that. So they have a history of doing that. So I believe that the subspace vortex was actually recycled from the Borg transport hub from Star Trek Voyager and a couple of episodes of Voyager.
Wow. Very cool. I like that.
But now, getting back to Andor, that's high praise. That's amazing. Wow. That's really... I think it's really cool. So let's get into it. What'd you think of episode 7? The process? The awakening?
Announcement.
The announcement.
Yeah. I thought it was great, man. I thought every episode was amazing. I think like every scene is like perfect. It's like just so good.
How many times have you seen the announcement?
Like 1.5.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So there was, just as a like on the surface, there was some cool, like Palpatine was mentioned.
Yes. A couple of times.
Yeah. And then there was a recurring character, Yularen, who is actually the one who mentions Clone Palpatine.
Wars. Yes, yes.
Yeah.
He's from Clone Wars, if I remember correctly, or Rebels, one of those
Both.
Two?
Both.
Okay.
So that's the thing, like, he's so obedient that during Clone Wars, he's fighting alongside Jedi, and then in Rebels, he's fighting against them.
Yeah.
He's fighting, and now he's full-on Empire guy. But he also is in episode 4. He's like one of the, like, that character was like used from episode 4.
Oh, was he in the Imperial meeting room?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So when they created the character for Clone Wars, they used some random actor with no speaking lines. They just made him
just
a thing
around the table. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. I mean, they've done that with a lot of characters in Star Wars, but that's really cool.
Yeah. And then the Grand Vizier, they brought the blue guy up, Palpatine's right-hand man. He was...
Mas Amedo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So his title is the Vizier. They talked about him quite a bit in this episode. So that was pretty cool. Just because he's just kind of a badass, so.
Well, one of the few aliens that Palpatine has left in control with power.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true.
Well, I mean, other than Grand Admiral Thrawn.
Yeah, and Sly Moore, whatever she does.
Right.
But just anytime he shows up, that's always a bad sign. And I just think they're the way they're making the rebellion very practical, that, you know, it takes money to do this. And I think they're the rebellion's at a point where, you know, there's infighting and it's to be expected because you, like, you can't trust anybody. But I do think they're aware of, like, well, not the characters, but the show is intentionally like that. Like,
yep.
Part of the fledgling here is that we have to unite. Because, like, if we're shooting each other in the back, we're losing numbers, and we need every man we can get for this rebellion to mean something. And I do think that that's part of the arc, is, like, learning to trust others. And you know, because in this show, the lead lady of the little rebel group is supposedly going to go kill Andor.
Val.
Yeah.
Yeah. So who is the one that gives that order? That's a new character, right? Or have we seen her before?
I gotta say, the whole time I was like, is that Leia?
Wow, did they recast? Because I was like, wow, that really looks like a young Carrie Fisher. But then she speaks and I'm like, oh, she's British.
Yeah. What is it? Is it the lady from the art gallery? The assistant?
Oh, maybe. Oh, maybe. Oh, you know what? I'm going to have to watch it again. And I was going to watch it again because it's such a good episode. But yeah, maybe. I didn't... Oh. Is it Luthen's...
assistant.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't... Okay. I did not catch that.
I'm not sure that was my... Because I was doing the same thing. I was like, because she's also, like, on the, like, the promo shot.
Yeah.
And, like, I don't know if we were supposed to be like, oh, Princess Leia's coming back. I don't know if that was, like, a red herring or something, but I was like, who the heck is this? But
so my other thought was that she's another Splinter Cell. So I'm really glad that you brought up that in this show that we're getting more facets of the rebellion. I love that. And I totally 100% agree with you. And that's what makes it so fascinating and entertaining. But on the flip side, this episode really reflects that same thing at the ISB, in the Empire.
Mm-hmm.
That, and I want to give you full credit, and I apologize to everyone that I did not see the sexism between Miro and Vladar. Is his name? Is that his name? I forget. I don't know.
Yeah.
But that was incredibly apparent in this episode, where he calls her out, and the boss says, "Nah, we're gonna give her. She's onto something. I trust her. I believe this. Let her go and investigate this." And then, you know, he goes, "Well done. Watch your back." That was... And then my other thing that I wanted to say is that this episode... And this is why I love Rogue One. And this episode in particular. Is that it's... You feel the after effects of the heist on Aldani. And the Empire is not... Yes, there's infighting because everyone's trying to, like, climb over each other and try to, like, you know, grab power and, you know, climb the ladder and, you know, all that other ridiculous nonsense of a fascist, you know, of a any organization. But it also showed us that there's competence there and that they ratcheted up a little bit. So, you know, the festivals that could hide rebels, you know, that's going to be, you know, now you can't even celebrate the eye, you know, at the end when the judge is handing out Cassian's sentence, she goes, "What was this, 6 months? Now it's 6 years."
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And all of those things that reverberate, I was like, dude, that's awesome. You know, and it makes it much more scary.
Yeah.
About the Empire is that
I felt
there
it in
is
my
competence
stomach.
There, and they rat and they turn it up a bit just because all those credits were stolen and they were beaten in that small instance.
I felt it in my stomach because it was like, because you're it's celebratory when they do the heist. It's like, oh, they did it, yay, hooray, and then this episode is the realization that they doomed everybody. They gave the Empire the nudge the Empire needed to be even shittier. And so it was, you know, one step forward, two steps back. So,
and so going back to your point, that conversation between Mon Mothma and Luthen, that was brilliant.
Yeah.
Like he was like, he's going further, and it didn't seem like Mon Mothma at the time, at that moment, was ready. Because she's like, you know, many people are going to die, and many people are going to suffer. Mm-hmm. And he goes something to the tune of, like, that's the name of the game, or that's the price we pay, right? Mm-hmm. And so with that... I thought the person who was instructing Vel to kill Cassian is another, like, splinter group. I want to say she works for Saw Gerrera.
Oh. Oh.
And that she's much more, you know, aggressive. And because, again, this is what Rogue One did brilliantly, is that the rebels aren't this one big happy family. It's a bunch of it's a spectrum, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of
yeah.
rebels to, let's call them terrorists, basically. Terrorist cells or whatever you want to call it. Like, yep. really, 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 you know, aggressive. And I thought, I was like, oh, this feels like a Saw Gerrera kind of deal.
Mm. Yeah.
But I don't know.
No, that's actually an excellent point. That would be an excellent way to reintroduce Saw Gerrera.
Because we know Forrest Whitaker makes an appearance in the show.
Yeah, because he's in like one of the trailers. So.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. And because Saw Gerrera is known to go to any length to achieve the end, the fact that she, the lady in the red, was commanding Vel to kill Andor, that is a very Saw Gerrera thing.
Yeah.
Because, as she says, we can't have Andor walking around with Luthien in his head.
Yeah, exactly.
And just on that note, so Vel is played by an actress who Game of Thrones fans will recognize.
Of course.
So yes. So there's this like order of assassins, paid assassins in Game of Thrones.
Okay.
And very iconic for Game of Thrones fans. You know, they worship the many-faced god, and they're very mysterious. They're able to shapeshift, but they're like masters of disguises and stuff. So one of the Stark kids, which is like the good guys, Arya, joins this this order, this guild, and there is an older girl there, and it's played by this actress who plays Vel, and
okay.
like, and she has it out for Arya from the get-go, and she's like this like murderous, calculating, like sociopath, and she almost has like glee in like the thought of killing Arya. So, and you can tell like the whole time she wants Arya gone, but then at one point Arya fails, and now this girl has permission to kill Arya, and so there's just like a whole episode with her hunting Arya. And she does such a good job because she's very young when she plays it. And so it's just like this, mm-hmm. like, I'm guessing teenage girl hunting this other teenage girl throughout the streets and ends up stabbing her in the stomach and stuff. And but she's like this like pure evil character. And so now in Andor, when just seeing her face, like her face has become iconic in that way, and just like mm-hmm. hearing her now again having the orders to kill Andor, it kind of sent shivers down my spine,
because
like I just couldn't help but think of that character from Game of Thrones.
Okay So I only know Faye Marsay, I think that's her name, Faye Marsay, right?
Is
something
it
like that?
I have no
yeah,
idea.
Yeah, I think the only place I had seen her, because I was like, whoa, I'm a big fan of the Darkest Hour, the film The Darkest Hour with Gary Oldman, who plays Churchill. She's
oh,
in that.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good one.
Yeah. Yeah. She's
he,
in
he
that.
He won an Oscar for that, I think.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was like, oh, it's Sybil from Darkest Hour. Okay. All right.
And you know what else is that? Shiro, is that her name? The Imperial officer lady?
Oh, yeah. Miro. Saying? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Miro. Okay. I think
Miro,
Vero,
something like that.
Shiro's a Zelda character. So her boss is also a Game of Thrones actor.
Yeah, I've heard.
He plays Qyburn, and he's basically this Frankenstein character.
Okay.
And he reanimates this huge soldier into like Frankenstein's monster. And
you mean the chief of the ISB?
Yeah. Yeah, like
boss.
Her boss.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I've heard that. I was like, okay, that didn't mean anything to me when that was, you know, oh, it's got so-and-so from Game of Thrones. And I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Very
cool.
He's
good in Game of Thrones too, so.
So I wanted to ask you, what do you think of Luthen so far? Could you say that he's like, no, okay, I'm going to stop there.
I mean, I think, I mean, Skarsgård is amazing. He's doing a great job.
Yeah. No, but what do you think of his character?
Well, but yeah, but it's just, it's hard to separate the character from Skarsgård because it's such a performance.
Okay.
It's such a performance. You know, he has to be duplicitous. And it's hard.
Yes,
it's hard to know
you.
The real Luthen, right?
Yes.
Because
yes,
he's literally acting. The character has to act. He has to act
yes.
as this art gallery, you know, whatever. And then, but then the real him when he meets with Andor is very serious. And like, I'd like to think that he's. I think you and I differ on. What we like I think to you, and obviously correct me if I'm wrong,
yeah,
I don't want to put words in your mouth. I think to you
no.
it would be more meaningful if Luthen was directing his hate at the Empire if it was tied to a specific motivation, like if the Empire had killed his wife or something and he was out for vengeance. And to me, I think I'm turned on by the idea that, like, this is just wrong. Fascism is wrong. And we should overthrow fascism at every
turn. So I do think that he has been impacted. I think you pegged it.
Yeah.
I do think he has been wronged. And I do think that it could just be that he is... that... whatever has happened to him, because I think we're gonna get that story. We obviously haven't gotten it yet.
Yeah.
But I do absolutely agree that yes. And he, to me, like in so many ways, is a little villainous at the same time. You're like, you're taking the cheat, you're taking the head of the ISB, and he's obviously, you know, quote-unquote villain, so is Miro and every Imperial officer.
Mm-hmm.
But then you take Luthen, and he orchestrates this heist and this push. And I'm like, ooh, that's a little bit villainous because you've got Mon Mothma in the middle. And that interaction between Luthen and Mon Mothma in the gallery, or in his art gallery... that was incredibly profound for me, because then she goes back to her party, or her husband's party, and, you know, asks the banker friend for access, and you're like, okay, you know, for her family's money to help bankroll this.
Yep.
And I'm like, wow, okay.
Yeah, like, but are you saying, like, on the table at this point is it could just be about money for Luthen?
No. I'm just saying, you know, as much as we see the Imperial officers as villains, I think there are many pseudo-villain, like, smaller V villains in this, and I think Luthen... is kind of pushing that boundary for me a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the blowback from the heist is perfectly illustrates that, or just because he was completely unaffected by that.
Yeah.
When they said they arrested 140 of the Dahollans, is that what they're called?
Yeah.
Dolans or whatever. He was completely unaffected by that. And I think we know arrest means worse than arrest.
Yes.
For at least many of them. I'm sure that chief is dead. The chief of them that we saw. I'm sure he's dead. But and then obviously the idea that Andor needs to be killed, that it seems to be approved by Luthen. So yeah, I totally agree.
So did you think that was K2SO when Andor is on on his resort planet there?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
Who do you think rescues him? Do you think it's Vel? Do you think she has a change of heart and is like,
Yeah. I don't know. Because, like, these shows have such a history of, like, introducing, you know, some crossover. So I'd like to be like, oh yeah, he's going to meet Han Solo in there. But like this show has demonstrated hardcore, they're not going to do that. Like they've had so many opportunities to bring
so
in.
So far.
And they just so allude to far. Them off screen.
Yes. Yes. So far.
Yeah. So I don't know, man. I have no clue. I do not have the faintest idea.
Okay.
Because we don't know what this prison's going to look like. I assume it's insane. I can't see how he would get out of it. So.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know, man.
Okay. So
what about
I also
you?
I just wanted to say I think the banker.
Yeah.
Mon Mothma's banker.
Yeah.
Is also going to be another character that becomes more important.
Yeah. Agreed.
See, do you think her husband has any faint idea? Do you think he's an Imperial? Do you think he's a spy? Do you think he's...
I don't know if he's a spy, but I think he sympathizes with the Empire. And that she said he can't be trusted, but I think that he would, I don't think he's spying on Mama, though.
Okay. Okay. But you do think he's sympathetic to the Empire?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. Okay. I think so too. I'm like, oh, that's going to suck, but whatever. Yeah.
Yep.
And then, so we haven't touched on this, but I really wanted to touch on it, that the flashback scene where Cassian sees his dad, his adopted dad.
Clem. Yeah.
Get hung.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because he's trying to stop these people from throwing rocks at these stormtroopers, and he kind of gets caught. I was like, wow. That's deep. That's really deep. I was like, wow. And then for his adoptive mom, Fiona Shaw, which has done a beautiful job, and I hope we get to see more of her in much more of an integral role. Like, when he asks her to leave, and she pauses and she's like, is she gonna leave? Like, is she gonna go with her? And I'm like, is she that old? And like, she does need the rest? But then her eyes tell you. Right? She's like, I'm not going anywhere. And then he comes back the next day and says, oh, yeah, not going anywhere.
Right. Yeah.
I'm in the rebellion. You know, I'm going to rebel against this. And, you know, I'm going to stay here and stand firm. That was, love that.
Yeah, it's good. It's really good. I'm enjoying the heck out of it, man.
Yeah.
So I do hesitate to say it's my favorite show ever because Game of Thrones was so good. And Game of Thrones is very me because Game of Thrones uses music as a character.
Okay.
Like there's so many scenes in that show where there's just like sweeping soundtrack and the camera is just like panned on it's just like on someone's face.
Yeah.
And nothing is happening other than like an expression on the character's face, but the music tells you everything. It tells the whole story.
Yeah.
And you know, there's a lot of scenes in Empire Strikes Back that are like that for me. And I don't know. I'm drawn in Lord of the Rings there's tons of stuff like that too.
Yeah. You know, and how's the one on Amazon so far?
Oh, season one has concluded. It's good. It's no Andor.
Okay.
But anyway, so my point is that this Andor show does not do that with the music. The music is good and the sound design is very good, but it's more like No Country for Old Men or something where the sound is very good, but you don't even know it's there. Like,
yeah.
So.
And the other thing about Andor that I want to just touch on is I'm so glad. I really wanted to hone in on the point that you had made. I'm so glad that thus far we haven't gotten, and I know we are going to get at least Saw Gerrera, and I'm so excited for that. But I'm really glad that so far we haven't seen Han Solo, Mando, you know, any of the other real characters that, you know, that we've met before. To say that I really want to see Palpatine in the Senate, though. Even though I think the Senate by this time is just this puppet chamber and that they kind of, you know, meet and then he doesn't even have to be there. But yeah, I'm really glad. And that there is no, like, Grogu kind of character, that we haven't gotten that either. Like, this plug or this one, like, you know, culture, you know, society kind of everyone. It's like, oh, yeah, it's, you know, Baby Yoda from... Mm-hmm. Not to criticize Baby Yoda or anything. I'm just using that character as an example of to illustrate a point that I'm glad that we're getting new characters and that we're, you know, getting background characters. You know, Mon Mothma was what? You know, in one scene in Return of the Jedi, you know, and then and that's really it, more or less.
Yeah. Yep, it's true. And now this Yularen guy.
Right.
But other than that, yeah, there hasn't been the excessive crossover callback thing.
Yes, it is the lower decks of the Star Wars universe, and I'm happy about that. I'm excited.
Yeah, me too. I do think though that like, and I think the show is doing it. I do think though that a real rebellion has to be at the end of the day, inspirational. Like there has to be, there does have to be like, you know, a sentiment or like figureheads that are like kind of celebrities of the movement type thing that people are drawn to and ideals. Like I think ultimately it is about ideals. And this show is very like intentional about not getting swept up in in like magical thinking and ideals. But I do think trying to evolve.
I think we're going to get there, though. I do think that there is going to be a turning point, and I do believe that there are going to be figures. And that's what I was trying to say so horrendously, horribly. I think there are going to be characters. I think Ty, the banker, is going to be one of them.
Yeah.
I think absolutely Mon Mothma is going to be the other. And I think Luthen is going to be one of them. And I think, you know, so many characters. I think there's going to be a group. And I think of people. And I think we're going to see, you know, Bail Organa, maybe. I think we are going to see this group of characters that becomes the essential core of the rebellion. I think you're getting ahead, but I do think we are going to get there at some point, for sure.
Yeah.
That's going to really be the spark to the flame, which I'm not going to go there.
Well, cool, man.
All right.
It's been real. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been fun, as always.
Yeah. Appreciate you talking to me, doing this crazy podcast.
Absolutely, bro.
All right. Well, everyone, thanks for listening, if you made it this far. And make sure to follow us on Twitter and subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform.
It's only been an hour and 20, so not too bad. About an hour and 20, so, you know.
Okay. All right. It's not too bad.
Not too bad.
All right, everyone.
I mean, they basically get two podcasts in one.
I know. It's true.
We really go deep into talk about Andor, too, so.
I know. That's why, you know, you should never miss an episode.
Exactly.
So. Hey, if you're on TikTok, follow me on TikTok. I'm Gabora. G-A-B-E-R-O.
O-R-A.
Thank you. Jesus. It's a long night. It's been a long night. So.
Yeah.
G-A-B-E-O-R-A. Gabora. Yep. Which is a Zelda reference. But anyway, I've been doing Zelda theories on there.
I was wondering if that was a Zelda reference.
Yeah, it's a Zelda reference.
Having known you for so long, I'm like, that's got to be a Zelda reference.
Yeah, there was in Ocarina of Time, you know the owl? I know you said your brother played Ocarina of Time. There's this iconic owl
that... Oh, yes. It's really annoying.
So yes. That owl's name is Gabora Kapora, and they say that he's an reincarnation of the sage Rauru. But then when Skyward Sword came out, like, decades later, Zelda's dad is named Gapora. So in Ocarina of Time, it's Gabora, but in Skyward Sword, it's Gapora. So anyway,
But is that just poor imagination on the character development part, and those are still two separate characters, and they just separate characters have fairly similar names? So
yeah, Zelda does this thing where there's
not
like
to say that the
spiritual
not
successors,
to say that the creators of Zelda are, you know,
no,
have poor imagination or anything. I don't mean any criticism or anything like that. I'm just
They're definitely separate characters, but the thing is that what they do is that most characters are like spiritual successors or predecessors to other characters, and so they reuse like the idea of characters. And in the case of Gapora, he resembles Rauru from Ocarina of Time, and so the idea is that he is a ancestor to Rauru, who then reincarnates as an owl.
Okay, gotcha. So, but, because we talk Star Wars a lot, I just wanted to, and I don't know anything about Zelda. Yeah. I just wanted to make sure this was not like an expanded universe kind of deal, and then it's like, nope. And then it was like kibosh, and it's like, nope, that stuff means nothing.
No, yeah, like, for a while, I always assumed playing Zelda growing up that it was like a multiverse thing. I thought each one was a standalone retelling of the same thing, but they have confirmed that it all is, you know, like one continuous timeline with like thousands of years in some cases
in between games. Okay, like, yeah. Gotcha.
So, but anyway, so Gabora is from Ocarina of Time, but I moved a B and an E. I switched them. So now my name's obviously Gabe, so Gabora. So it's very fitting for me because I'm obsessed with Zelda. So
yes.
Yeah. Anyway, until next time.
Yep.
Live
thank
long
you.
And prosper.
And may the force be with you.
See ya.